sentence. He drafted the letter first in German and then in English on the back of a piece of scrap paper that he had filled with a variety of equations that apparently, given how they trail off, led to nothing. Truman bucked the decision to incoming President Eisenhower, who allowed the executions to proceed. Einstein's letter to Truman was released publicly, and the New York Times ran a front-page story headlined, "Einstein Supports Rosenberg Appeal." More than 100 angry letters swept in from across the nation. "You need some common sense plus some appreciation for what America has given you," wrote Marion Rawls of Portsmouth, Virginia. "You place the Jew first and the United States second," said Charles Williams of White Plains, New York. From Corporal Homer Green, serving in Korea, "You evidently like to see our GIs killed. Go to Russia or back where you came from, because I don't like Americans like you living off this country and making un-American statements." There were not as many positive letters, but Einstein did have a pleasant exchange with the liberal Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas, who had unsuccessfully tried to stop the executions. "You have struggled so devotedly for the creation of a healthy public opinion in our troubled time," Einstein wrote in a note of appreciation. Douglas sent back a handwritten reply. "You have paid me a tribute which brightens the burdens of this dark hour, a tribute I will always cherish." Many of the critical letters asked Einstein why he was willing to speak out for the Rosenbergs, but not for the 9 Jewish doctors whom Stalin had put on trial as part of an alleged Zionist conspiracy to murder Russian leaders. Among those who publicly challenged what they saw as Einstein's double standard were the publisher of the New York Post and the editor of the New Leader. Einstein agreed that the Russian actions should be denounced. "The perversion of justice which manifests itself in all the official trials staged by the Russian government deserves unconditional condemnation," he wrote. He added that individual appeals to Stalin would probably not do much, but perhaps a joint declaration from a group of scholars would help. So he got together with the chemistry Nobel laureate, Harold Urey, and others to issue one. Einstein and Urey hit Red's anti-Semitism, the New York Times reported. After Stalin died a few weeks later, the doctors were freed. On the other hand, he stressed in scores of letters and statements that Americans should not let the fear of communism cause them to surrender the civil liberties and freedom of thought that they cherished. There were a lot of domestic communists in England, but the people there did not get themselves whipped into a frenzy by internal security investigations, he pointed out. Americans need not either. William Frauenglass. Every year, Lord & Taylor department stores gave an award that, especially in the early 1950s, might have seemed unusual. It honored independent thinking, and Einstein, fittingly, won it in 1953 for his nonconformity in scientific matters. Einstein took pride in that trait, which he knew had served him well over the years. "It gives me great pleasure to see the stubbornness of an incorrigible nonconformist warmly acclaimed," he said in his radio talk, accepting the award. Even though he was being honored for his nonconformity in the field of science, Einstein used the occasion to turn attention to the McCarthy-style investigations. For him, freedom in the realm of thought was linked to freedom in the realm of politics. "To be sure, we are concerned here with nonconformism in a remote field of endeavor," he said, meaning physics. "No senatorial committee has as yet felt compelled to tackle the task of combating in this field the dangers that threaten the inner security of the uncritical or intimidated citizen." Listening to his talk was a Brooklyn schoolteacher, William Frauenglass, who had, a month earlier, been called to testify in Washington before a Senate Internal Security Subcommittee looking into communist influence in high schools. He had refused to talk, and now he wanted Einstein to say whether he had been right. Einstein crafted a reply and told Frauenglass he could make it public. "The reactionary politicians have managed to instill suspicions of all intellectual efforts," he wrote. "They are now proceeding to suppress the freedom of teaching. What should intellectuals do against this evil? Frankly, I can only see the revolutionary way of non-cooperation in the sense of Gandhi's," Einstein declared. "Every intellectual who is called before one of the committees ought to refuse to testify. Einstein's lifelong comfort in resisting prevailing winds made him serenely stubborn during the McCarthy era. At a time when citizens were asked to name names and testify at inquiries into their loyalty and that of their colleagues, he took a simple approach. He told people not to cooperate. He felt, as he told Frauenglass, that this should be done based on the free speech guarantees of the First Amendment, rather than the subterfuge of invoking the Fifth Amendment's protection against possible self-incrimination. Standing up for the First Amendment was particularly a duty of intellectuals, he said, because they had a special role in society as preservers of free thought. He was still horrified that most intellectuals in Germany had not risen in resistance when the Nazis came to power. When his letter to Frauenglass was published, there was an even greater public uproar than had been provoked by his Rosenberg appeal. Editorial writers across the nation pulled out all the stops for their denunciatory chords. The New York Times, to employ unnatural and illegal forces of civil disobedience, as Professor Einstein advises, is, in this case, to attack one evil with another. The situation which Professor Einstein rebels against certainly needs correction, but the answer does not lie in defying the law. The Washington Post. He has put himself in the extremist category by his irresponsible suggestion. He has proved once more that genius in science is no guarantee of sagacity in political affairs. The Philadelphia Inquirer. It is particularly regrettable when a scholar of his attainments, full of honors, should permit himself to be used as an instrument of propaganda by the enemies of the country that has given him such a secure refuge. Dr. Einstein has come down from the stars to dabble in ideological politics with lamentable results. The Chicago Daily Tribune. It is always astonishing to find that a man of great intellectual power in some directions is a simpleton or even a jackass in others. The Pueblo, Colorado Star Journal. He, of all people, should know better. This country protected him from Hitler. Ordinary citizens wrote as well. Look in the mirror and see how disgraceful you look without a haircut like a wild man and wear a Russian wool cap like a Bolshevik, said Sam Epkin of Cleveland. The anti-communist columnist Victor Lasky sent a handwritten screed. Your most recent blast against the institutions of this great nation finally convinces me that, despite your great scientific knowledge, you're an idiot, a menace to this country. And George Stringfellow of East Orange, New Jersey, noted incorrectly, don't forget that you left a communist country to come here where you could have freedom. Don't abuse that freedom, sir. Senator McCarthy also issued a denunciation, though it seems slightly muted due to Einstein's stature. Anyone who advises Americans to keep secret information, which they have, about spies and saboteurs is himself an enemy of America, he said, not quite aiming directly at Einstein or what he had written. This time, however, there were actually more letters in support of Einstein. Among the more amusing riposts came from his friend Bertrand Russell. You seem to think that one should always obey the law, however bad, the philosopher wrote to the New York Times. I am compelled to suppose that you condemn George Washington and hold that your country ought to return to allegiance to Her Gracious Majesty Queen Elizabeth II. As a loyal Briton, I, of course, applaud this view, but I fear it may not win much support in your country. Einstein wrote Russell a thank-you letter, lamenting, All the intellectuals of this country, down to the youngest student, have become completely intimidated. Abraham Flexner, now retired from the Institute for Advanced Study and living on Fifth Avenue, took the opportunity to restore his relationship with Einstein. I am grateful to you as a Native American for your fine letter to Mr. Frauenglass, he wrote. American citizens in general will occupy a more dignified position if they absolutely refuse to say a word if questioned about their personal opinions and beliefs. Among the most poignant notes was from Frauenglass's teenage son, Richard. In these troubled times, your statement is one that might alter the course of this nation, he said, which had a bit of truth to it. He noted that he would cherish Einstein's letter for the rest of his life, and then added a P.S. My favorite subjects are your favorite, too, math and physics. Now I am taking trigonometry. Passive resistance. Dozens of dissenters subsequently begged Einstein to intervene on their behalf, but he declined. He had made his point and did not see the need to keep thrusting himself into the fray. But one person did get through. Albert Shadowitz, a physics professor who had worked as an engineer during the war and helped form a union that was eventually expelled from the labor movement for having communists on its board. Senator McCarthy wanted to show that the union had ties to Moscow and had endangered the defense industry. Shadowitz, who had been a member of the Communist Party, decided to invoke the protections of the First, not the Fifth, Amendment, as Einstein had recommended to Frauenglass. Shadowitz was so worried about his plight that he decided to call Einstein for support. But Einstein's number was unlisted. So he got into his car in northern New Jersey, drove to Princeton, and showed up at Einstein's house, where he was met by the zealous guardian Dukas. "Do you have an appointment?" she demanded. He admitted he didn't. "Well, you can't just come in and speak to Professor Einstein," she declared. But when he explained his story, she stared at him for a while, then waved him in. Einstein was wearing his usual attire, a baggy sweatshirt and corduroy trousers. He took Shadowitz upstairs to his study and assured him that his actions were right. He was an intellectual, and it was the special duty of intellectuals to stand up in such cases. "If you take this path, then feel free to use my name in any way that you wish," Einstein generously offered. Shadowitz was surprised by the blank check, but happy to use it. McCarthy's chief counsel, Roy Cohn, did the questioning as McCarthy listened during the initial closed hearing. "Was he a communist?" Shadowitz replied, "I refuse to answer that, and I'm following the advice of Professor Einstein." McCarthy suddenly took over the questioning. "Did he know Einstein?" "Not really," Shadowitz answered, "but I've met him." When the script was replayed in an open hearing, it made the same type of headlines and provoked the same spurt of mail as the Frauenglass case had. Einstein believed he was being a good rather than a disloyal citizen. He had read the First Amendment and felt that upholding its spirit was at the core of America's cherished freedom. One angry critic sent him a copy of a card that contained what he called the American Creed. It read, in part, "It is my duty to my country to love it, to support its constitution, to obey its laws." Einstein wrote on the edge, "This is precisely what I have done." When the great black scholar W.E.B. Du Bois was indicted on charges stemming from helping to circulate a petition initiated by the World Peace Council, Einstein volunteered to testify as a character witness on his behalf. It represented a union of Einstein's sentiments on behalf of civil rights and of free speech. When Du Bois's lawyer informed the court that Einstein would appear, the judge rather quickly decided to dismiss the case. Another case hit closer to home, that of J. Robert Oppenheimer. After leading the scientists who developed the atom bomb and then becoming head of the institute where Einstein still puttered into work, Oppenheimer remained an advisor to the Atomic Energy Commission and kept his security clearance. By initially opposing the development of the hydrogen bomb, he had turned Edward Teller into an adversary, and he also alienated AEC Commissioner Louis Strauss. Oppenheimer's wife Kitty and his brother Frank had been members of the Communist Party before the war, and Oppenheimer himself had associated freely with party members and with scientists whose loyalty came under question. All of this prompted an effort in 1953 to strip Oppenheimer of his security clearance. It would have expired soon anyway, and everyone could have allowed the matter to be resolved quietly, but in the heated atmosphere, neither Oppenheimer nor his adversaries wanted to back away from what they saw as a matter of principle. So a secret hearing was scheduled in Washington. One day at the Institute, Einstein ran into Oppenheimer, who was preparing for the hearings. They chatted for a few minutes, and when Oppenheimer got to his car, he recounted the conversation to a friend. "Einstein thinks that the attack on me is so outrageous that I just should resign," he said. Einstein considered Oppenheimer a fool for even answering the charges. Having served his country admirably, he had no obligations to subject himself to a witch hunt. A few days after the secret hearings finally began, in April 1954, just as CBS journalist Edward R. Murrow was taking on Joseph McCarthy and the controversy over security investigations was at its height, they became public through a Page One exclusive by James Reston of the New York Times. The issue of the government's investigation of Oppenheimer's loyalty instantly became another polarizing public debate. Warned that the story was about to break, Abraham Pais went to Mercer Street to make sure that Einstein was prepared for the inevitable press calls. He was bitterly amused when Pais told him that Oppenheimer continued to insist on a hearing rather than simply cutting his ties with the government. The trouble with Oppenheimer is that he loves a woman who doesn't love him, the United States government, Einstein said. All Oppenheimer had to do, Einstein told Pais, was go to Washington, tell the officials that they were fools, and then go home. Oppenheimer lost. The AEC voted that he was a loyal American, but also a security risk, and, one day before it would have expired anyway, revoked his clearance. Einstein visited him at the Institute the next day and found him depressed. That evening he told a friend that he did not understand why Oppenheimer takes the business so seriously. When a group of Institute faculty members circulated a petition affirming support for their director, Einstein immediately signed up. Others initially declined, some partly out of fear. This galvanized Einstein. He put his revolutionary talents into action to garner support, a friend recalled. After a few more meetings, Einstein had helped to convince, or shame, everyone into signing the statement. Louis Strauss, Oppenheimer's AEC antagonist, was on the board of the Institute, which worried the faculty. Would he try to get Oppenheimer fired? Einstein wrote his friend Senator Herbert Lehman of New York, another trustee, calling Oppenheimer by far the most capable director the Institute has ever had. Dismissing him, he said, would arouse the justified indignation of all men of learning. The trustees voted to keep him. Soon after the Oppenheimer affair, Einstein was visited in Princeton by Adlai Stevenson, the once and future Democratic nominee for president, who was a particular darling among intellectuals. Einstein expressed concern at the way politicians were whipping up fear of communism. Stevenson replied somewhat circumspectly. The Russians were, in fact, a danger. After some more gentle back and forth, Stevenson thanked Einstein for endorsing him in 1952. There was no need for thanks, Einstein replied, as he had done so only because he trusted Eisenhower even less. Stevenson said he found such honesty refreshing, and Einstein decided that he was not quite as pompous as he had originally seemed. Einstein's opposition to McCarthyism arose partly out of his fear of fascism. America's most dangerous internal threat, he felt, came not from communist subversives, but from those who used the fear of communists to trample civil liberties. America is incomparably less endangered by its own communists than by the hysterical hunt for the few communists that are here, he told the socialist leader Norman Thomas. Even to people he did not know, Einstein expressed his disgust in unvarnished terms. We have come a long way toward the establishment of a fascist regime, he replied to an 11-page letter sent to him by a New Yorker he had never met. The similarity of general conditions here to those in the Germany of 1932 is quite obvious. Some colleagues worried that Einstein's vocal opinions would cause controversy for the Institute. Such concerns, he joked, made his hair turn gray. Indeed, he took a boyish American glee at his freedom to say whatever he felt. I have become a kind of enfant terrible in my new homeland due to my inability to keep silent and to swallow everything that happens, he wrote Queen Mother Elizabeth. Besides, I believe that older people who have scarcely anything to lose ought to be willing to speak out in behalf of those who are young and are subject to much greater restraint. He even announced, in tones both grave and a bit playful, that he would not have become a professor given the political intimidation that now existed. If I were a young man again and had to decide how to make a living, I would not try to become a scientist or scholar or teacher, he intoned to Theodore White of the Reporter magazine. I would rather choose to be a plumber or a peddler, in the hope of finding that modest degree of independence still available. That earned him an honorary membership card from a plumber's union, and it sparked a national debate on academic freedom. even slightly frivolous remarks made by Einstein carried a lot of momentum. Einstein was right that academic freedom was under assault, and the damage done to careers was real. For example, David Bohm, a great theoretical physicist who worked with Oppenheimer and Einstein in Princeton and refined certain aspects of quantum mechanics, was called before the House Un-American Activities Committee, pleaded the Fifth Amendment, lost his job, and ended up moving to Brazil. Nevertheless, Einstein's remark and his litany of doom turned out to be overstated. Despite his impolitic utterances, there was no serious attempt to muzzle him or threaten his job. Even the slapstick FBI efforts to compile a dossier on him did not curtail his free speech. At the end of the Oppenheimer investigation, both he and Einstein were still harbored safely in their haven in Princeton, free to think and speak as they chose. The fact that both men had their loyalty questioned and at times their security clearances denied was shameful, but it was not like Nazi Germany, not anything close, despite what Einstein sometimes said. Einstein and some other refugees tended, understandably, to view McCarthyism as a descent into the black hole of fascism, not as one of those ebbs and flows of excess that happen in a democracy. As it turned out, American democracy righted itself, as it always has. McCarthy was relegated to his own disgrace in 1954 by Army lawyers, his Senate colleagues, President Eisenhower, and journalists such as Drew Pearson and Edward R. Murrow. When the transcript of the Oppenheimer case was published, it ended up hurting the reputation of Louis Strauss and Edward Teller, at least within the academic and scientific establishment, as much as that of Oppenheimer. Einstein was not used to self-righting political systems, nor did he fully appreciate how resilient America's democracy and its nurturing of individual liberty could be. So for a while his disdain deepened, but he was saved from serious despair by his wry detachment and his sense of humor. He was not destined to die a bitter man. Chapter 25 The End, 1955. Intimations of Mortality. For his 75th birthday in March 1954, Einstein received from a medical center, unsolicited, a pet parrot that was delivered in a box to his doorstep. It had been a difficult journey, and the parrot seemed traumatized. At the time, Einstein was seeing a woman who worked in one of Princeton University's libraries, named Joanna Fantova, whom he had met back in Germany in the 1920s. The pet parrot is depressed after his traumatic delivery, and Einstein is trying to cheer him up with his jokes, which the bird doesn't seem to appreciate, she wrote in the wonderful journal she kept of their dates and conversations. The parrot rebounded psychologically and was soon eating out of Einstein's hand, but it developed an infection. That necessitated a series of injections, and Einstein worried that the bird would not survive. But it was a tough bird, and after only two injections, he bounced back. Einstein likewise had repeatedly bounced back from bouts of anemia and stomach ailments, but he knew that the aneurysm on his abdominal aorta should soon prove fatal, and he began to display a peaceful sense of his own mortality. When he stood at the graveside and eulogized the physicist Rudolf Leidenberg, who had been his colleague in Berlin and then Princeton, the words seemed to be ones he felt personally. "Brief is this existence as a fleeting visit in a strange house," he said. "The path to be pursued is poorly lit by a flickering consciousness." He seemed to sense that this final transition he was going through was at once natural and somehow spiritual. The strange thing about growing old is that the intimate identification with the here and now is slowly lost, he wrote his friend, the Queen Mother of Belgium. One feels transposed into infinity, more or less alone. After his colleagues updated, as a 75th birthday gift, the music system they had given him 5 years earlier, Einstein began repeatedly to play an RCA Victor recording of Beethoven's Missa Solemnis. It was an unusual choice for two reasons. He tended to regard Beethoven, who was not his favorite composer, as too personal, almost naked. Also, his religious instincts did not usually include these sort of trappings. "I am a deeply religious non-believer," he noted to a friend who had sent him birthday greetings. "This is a somewhat new kind of religion." It was a time for reminiscing. When his old friends Conrad Habicht and Maurice Solovine wrote a postcard from Paris recalling their time together in Bern, more than a half-century earlier, as members of their self-proclaimed Olympia Academy, Einstein replied with a paean addressed to that bygone institution. "Though somewhat decrepit, we still follow the solitary path of our life by your pure and inspiring light." As he later lamented in another letter to Solovine, "The devil counts out the years conscientiously." Despite his stomach problems, he still loved to walk. Sometimes it was with Gödel to and from the Institute. At other times it was in the woods near Princeton with his stepdaughter, Margot. Their relationship had become even closer, but their walks were usually enjoyed in silence. She noticed that he was becoming mellower, both personally and politically. His judgments were mild, even sweet rather than harsh. He had in particular made his peace with Hans Albert. Shortly after he celebrated his 75th birthday, his son turned 50. Einstein, thanks to a reminder from his son's wife, wrote him a letter that was slightly formal, as if created for a special occasion. But it contained a nice tribute both to his son and to the value of a life in science. "It is a joy for me to have a son who has inherited the main traits of my personality, the ability to rise above mere existence by sacrificing oneself through the years for an impersonal goal." That fall, Hans Albert came east for a visit. By then, Einstein had finally discovered what was fundamental about America. It can be swept by waves of what may seem to outsiders to be dangerous political passions, but are instead passing sentiments that are absorbed by its democracy and righted by its constitutional gyroscope. McCarthyism had died down, and Eisenhower had proved a calming influence. "God's own country becomes stranger and stranger," Einstein wrote Hans Albert that Christmas. "But somehow they managed to return to normality. Everything, even lunacy, is mass-produced here, but everything goes out of fashion very quickly." Almost every day he continued to amble to the Institute to wrestle with his equations and try to push them a little closer toward the horizon of a unified field theory. He would come in with his new ideas, often clutching equations on scraps of paper he had scribbled the night before, and go over them with his assistant in that final year, Ruria Kaufmann, a physicist from Israel. She would write the new equations on a blackboard so they could ponder them together and point out problems. Einstein would then try to counter them. "He had certain criteria by which to judge whether this is relevant to physical reality or not," she recounted. Even when they were defeated by the obstacles to a new approach, as they invariably were, Einstein remained optimistic. "Well, we've learned something," he would say as the clock ticked down. In the evening, he would often explain his last-ditch efforts to his companion, Joanna Fantova, and she would record them in her journal. The entries for 1954 were littered with hopes raised and dashed. February 20th. "Thinks he found a new angle to his theory, something very important that would simplify it. Hopes he won't find any errors." February 21st. "Didn't find any errors, but the new work isn't as exciting as he had thought the day before." August 25th. "Einstein's equations are looking good. Maybe something will come of them. But it's damned hard work." September 21st. "He's making some progress with what was at first only a theory, but is now looking good." October 14th, "found an error in his work today, which is a setback." October 24th, "he calculated like crazy today, but accomplished nothing." That year, Wolfgang Pauli, the quantum mechanics pioneer, came to visit. Again, the old debate over whether God would play dice was re-engaged, as it had been a quarter century earlier at the Solvay conferences. Einstein told Pauli that he still objected to the fundamental tenet in quantum mechanics that a system can be defined only by specifying the experimental method of observing it. There was a reality, he insisted, that was independent of how we observed it. Einstein has the philosophical prejudice that a state, termed real, can be defined objectively under any circumstances, that is, without specification of the experimental arrangement used to examine the system, Pauli marveled in a letter to Max Born. He also clung to his belief that physics should be based, as he told his old friend Besso, on the field concept, i.e. on continuous structures. 70 years earlier, his awe at contemplating a compass caused him to marvel at the concept of fields, and they had guided his theories ever since. But what would happen, he worried to Besso, if field theory turned out to be unable to account for particles and quantum mechanics? In that case, nothing remains of my entire castle in the air, gravitation theory included. So, even as Einstein apologized for his stubbornness, he proudly refused to abandon it. I must seem like an ostrich, who forever buries its head in the relativistic sand in order not to face the evil quanta, he wrote Louis de Broglie, another of his colleagues in the long struggle. He had found his gravitational theories by trusting an underlying principle, and that made him a fanatic believer that comparable methods would eventually lead to a unified field theory. This should explain the ostrich policy, he wryly told de Broglie. He expressed this more formally in the concluding paragraph of his final updated appendix to his popular book, Relativity, the Special and General Theory. The conviction prevails that the experimentally assured duality, corpuscular and wave structure, can be realized only by such a weakening of the concept of reality, he wrote. I think that such a far-reaching theoretical renunciation is not, for the present, justified by our actual knowledge, and that one should not desist from pursuing to the end the path of the relativistic field theory. Bertrand Russell encouraged him to continue, in addition, the search for a structure that would ensure peace in the atomic age. They had both opposed the First World War, Russell recalled, and supported the Second. Now it was imperative to prevent a Third. I think that eminent men of science ought to do something dramatic to bring home to the governments the disasters that may occur, Russell wrote. Einstein replied by proposing a public declaration that they, and perhaps a few other eminent scientists and thinkers, could sign. Einstein set to work enlisting his old friend and sparring partner, Niels Bohr. Don't frown like that, Einstein joked, as if he were face to face with Bohr, rather than writing to him in Copenhagen. This has nothing to do with our old controversy on physics, but rather concerns a matter on which we are in complete agreement. Einstein admitted that his own name might carry some influence abroad, but not in America, where I am known as a black sheep, and not merely in scientific matters. Alas, Bohr declined, but 9 other scientists, including Max Born, agreed to join the effort. Russell concluded the proposed document with a simple plea. In view of the fact that in any future world war, nuclear weapons will certainly be employed, and that such weapons threaten the continued existence of mankind, we urge the governments of the world to realize and to acknowledge publicly that their purpose cannot be furthered by a world war, and we urge them, consequently, to find peaceful means for the settlement of all matters of dispute between them. Einstein made it to his 76th birthday, but he was not well enough to come outside to wave to the reporters and the photographers gathered in front of 112 Mercer Street. The mailman delivered presents. Oppenheimer came by with papers, the Bucky family brought some puzzles, and Joanna Fantova was there to record the events. Among the presents was a tie sent by the 5th grade of the Farmingdale Elementary School in New York, which presumably had seen pictures of him and thought he could use one. "Neckties exist for me only as remote memories," he admitted politely in his letter of thanks. A few days later, he learned of the death of Michaela Besso, the personal confessor and scientific sounding board he had met 6 decades earlier upon arriving as a student in Zurich. As if he knew that he had only a few more weeks, Einstein ruminated on the nature of death and time in the condolence letter he wrote to Besso's family. "He has departed from this strange world a little ahead of me. That means nothing, For us believing physicists, the distinction between past, present, and future is only a stubborn illusion. Einstein had introduced Bessel to his wife, Anna Winterler, and he marveled as his friend made the marriage survive despite some difficult patches. Bessel's most admirable personal trait, Einstein said, was to live in harmony with a woman, an undertaking in which I twice failed rather miserably. One Sunday in April, the Harvard historian of science I. Bernard Cohen went to see Einstein. His face, deeply lined, struck Cohen as tragic, yet his sparkling eyes made him seem ageless. He spoke softly, yet laughed loudly. Every time he made a point that he liked, Cohen recalled, he would burst into booming laughter. Einstein was particularly amused by a scientific gadget designed to show the equivalence principle that he had recently been given. It was a version of the old-fashioned toy in which a ball that hangs by a string from the end of a stick has to be swung up so that it lands in a cup atop the stick. This one was more complex. The string tied to the ball went through the bottom of the cup and was attached to a loose spring inside the handle of the contraption. Random shaking would get the ball in the cup every now and then. The challenge? Was there a method that would get the ball in the cup every time? As Cohen was leaving, a big grin came over Einstein's face as he said he would explain the answer to the gadget. "Now, the equivalence principle," he announced. He poked the stick upward until it almost touched the ceiling, then let it drop straight down. The ball, while in free fall, behaved as if it was weightless. The spring inside the contraption instantly pulled it into the cup. Einstein was now entering the last week of his life, and it is fitting that he focused on the matters most important to him. On April 11th, he signed the Einstein-Russell Manifesto. As Russell later declared, "He remained sane in a mad world." Out of that document grew the Pugwash conferences, in which scientists and thinkers gathered annually to discuss how to control nuclear weapons. Later that same afternoon, Israeli Ambassador Abba Ibn arrived at Mercer Street to discuss a radio address Einstein was scheduled to give to commemorate the 7th anniversary of the Jewish state. He would be heard, Ibn told him, by as many as 60 million listeners. Einstein was amused. "So, I shall now have a chance to become world famous," he smiled. After rattling around in the kitchen to make Ibn a cup of coffee, Einstein told him that he saw the birth of Israel as one of the few political acts in his lifetime that had a moral quality. But he was concerned that the Jews were having trouble learning to live with the Arabs. "The attitude we adopt toward the Arab minority will provide the real test of our moral standards as a people," he had told a friend a few weeks earlier. He wanted to broaden his speech, which he was scribbling in German in a very tight and neat handwriting, to urge the creation of a world government to preserve peace. Einstein went in to work at the Institute the next day, but he had a pain in his groin, and it showed on his face. "Is everything all right?" his assistant asked. "Everything is all right," he replied, "but I am not." He stayed at home the following day, partly because the Israeli consul was coming and partly because he was still not feeling well. After the visitors left, he lay down for a nap, but Dukas heard him rush to the bathroom in the middle of the afternoon, where he collapsed. The doctors gave him morphine, which helped him sleep, and Dukas set up her bed right next to his so that she could put ice on his dehydrated lips throughout the night. His aneurysm had started to break. A group of doctors convened at his home the next day, and after some consultation they recommended a surgeon who might be able, though it was thought unlikely, to repair the aorta. Einstein refused. "It is tasteless to prolong life artificially," he told Dukas. "I have done my share. It is time to go. I will do it elegantly." He did ask, however, whether he would suffer a horrible death. The answer, the doctor said, was unclear. The pain of an internal hemorrhage could be excruciating, but it may take only a minute, or maybe an hour. To Dukas, who became overwrought, he smiled and said, "You're really hysterical. I have to pass on some time, and it doesn't really matter when." Dukas found him the next morning in agony, unable to lift his head. She rushed to the telephone, and the doctor ordered him to the hospital. At first he refused, but he was told he was putting too much of a burden on Dukas, so he relented. The volunteer medic in the ambulance was a political economist at Princeton, and Einstein was able to carry on a lively conversation with him. Margot called Hans Albert, who caught a plane from San Francisco and was soon at his father's bedside. The economist Otto Nathan, a fellow German refugee who had become his close friend, arrived from New York. But Einstein was not quite ready to die. On Sunday, April 11th, he woke up feeling better. He asked Dukas to get him his glasses, papers, and pencils, and he proceeded to jot down a few calculations. He talked to Hans Albert about some scientific ideas, then to Nathan about the dangers of allowing Germany to rearm. Pointing to his equations, he lamented, half-jokingly, to his son, "If only I had more mathematics." For a half-century, he had been bemoaning both German nationalism and the limits of his mathematical toolbox, so it was fitting that these should be among his final utterances. He worked as long as he could, and when the pain got too great, he went to sleep. Shortly after 1 a.m. on Monday, April 18, 1955, the nurse heard him blurt out a few words in German that she could not understand. The aneurysm, like a big blister, had burst, and Einstein died at age 76. At his bedside lay the draft of his undelivered speech for Israel Independence Day. "I speak to you today not as an American citizen and not as a Jew, but as a human being," it began. Also by his bed were 12 pages of tightly written equations, littered with crossouts and corrections. To the very end, he struggled to find his elusive unified field theory. And the final thing he wrote, before he went to sleep for the last time, was one more line of symbols and numbers that he hoped might get him and the rest of us just a little step closer to the spirit manifest in the laws of the universe. Epilogue. Einstein's brain and Einstein's mind. When Sir Isaac Newton died, his body lay in state in the Jerusalem chamber of Westminster Abbey, and his pallbearers included the Lord High Chancellor, 2 dukes, and 3 earls. Einstein could have had a similar funeral, glittering with dignitaries from around the world. Instead, in accordance with his wishes, he was cremated in Trenton on the afternoon that he died, before most of the world had heard the news. There were only 12 people at the crematorium, including Hans Albert Einstein, Helen Dukas, Otto Nathan, and 4 members of the Bucky family. Nathan recited a few lines from Goethe, and then took Einstein's ashes to the nearby Delaware River, where they were scattered. No other man contributed so much to the vast expansion of 20th-century knowledge, President Eisenhower declared. Yet no other man was more modest in the possession of the power that is knowledge, more sure that power without wisdom is deadly. The New York Times ran 9 stories plus an editorial about his death the next day. "Man stands on this diminutive earth, gazes at the myriad stars and upon billowing oceans and tossing trees, and wonders, what does it all mean? How did it come about? The most thoughtful wanderer who appeared among us in 3 centuries has passed on in the person of Albert Einstein." Einstein had insisted that his ashes be scattered so that his final resting place would not become the subject of morbid veneration. But there was one part of his body that was not cremated. In a drama that would seem farcical were it not so macabre, Einstein's brain ended up being, for more than 4 decades, a wandering relic. Hours after Einstein's death, what was supposed to be a routine autopsy was performed by the pathologist at Princeton Hospital, Thomas Harvey, a small-town Quaker with a sweet disposition and rather dreamy approach to life and death. As a distraught Otto Nathan watched silently, Harvey removed and inspected each of Einstein's major organs, ending by using an electric saw to cut through his skull and remove his brain. When he stitched the body back up, he decided, without asking permission, to embalm Einstein's brain and keep it. The next morning, in a 5th-grade class at a Princeton school, the teacher asked her students what news they had heard. "Einstein died," said one girl, eager to be the first to come up with that piece of information. But she quickly found herself topped by a usually quiet boy who sat in the back of the class. "My dad's got his brain," he said. Nathan was horrified when he found out, as was Einstein's family. Hans Albert called the hospital to complain, but Harvey insisted that there may be scientific value to studying the brain. Einstein would have wanted that, he said. The son, unsure what legal and practical rights he now had in this matter, reluctantly went along. Soon, Harvey was besieged by those who wanted Einstein's brain, or a piece of it. He was summoned to Washington to meet with officials of the U.S. Army's pathology unit, but despite their requests, he refused to show them his prized possession. Guarding it had become a mission. He finally decided to have friends at the University of Pennsylvania turn part of it into microscopic slides, and so he put Einstein's brain, now chopped into pieces, into two glass cookie jars and drove it there in the back of his Ford. Over the years, in a process that was at once guileless as well as bizarre, Harvey would send off slides or chunks of the remaining brain to random researchers who struck his fancy. He demanded no rigorous studies, and for years none were published. In the meantime, he quit Princeton Hospital, left his wife, remarried a couple of times, and moved around from New Jersey to Missouri to Kansas, often leaving no forwarding address, the remaining fragments of Einstein's brain always with him. Every now and then a reporter would stumble across the story and track Harvey down, causing a minor media flurry. Stephen Levy, then of New Jersey Monthly and later of Newsweek, found him in 1978 in Wichita, where he pulled a mason jar of Einstein's brain chunks from a box labeled Costa Cider in the corner of his office behind a red plastic picnic cooler. 20 years later, Harvey was tracked down once again by Michael Paterniti, a free-spirited and soulful writer for Harper's, who turned his road trip in a rented Buick across America with Harvey and the brain into an award-winning article and best-selling book, Driving Mr. Albert. Their destination was California, where they paid a call on Einstein's granddaughter, Evelyn Einstein. She was divorced, marginally employed, and struggling with poverty. Harvey's perambulations with the brain struck her as creepy, but she had a particular interest in one secret it might hold. She was the adopted daughter of Hans Albert and his wife Frieda, but the timing and circumstances of her birth were murky. She had heard rumors that made her suspect that possibly, just possibly, she might actually be Einstein's own daughter. She had been born after Elsa's death, when Einstein was spending time with a variety of women. Perhaps she had been the result of one of those liaisons, and he had arranged for her to be adopted by Hans Albert. Working with Robert Schulman, an early editor of the Einstein Papers, she hoped to see what could be learned by studying the DNA from Einstein's brain. Unfortunately, it turned out that the way Harvey had embalmed the brain made it impossible to extract usable DNA. And so her questions were never answered. In 1998, after 43 years as the wandering guardian of Einstein's brain, Thomas Harvey, by then 86, decided it was time to pass on the responsibility. So he called the person who currently held his old job as pathologist at Princeton Hospital and went by to drop it off. Of the dozens of people to whom Harvey doled out pieces of Einstein's brain over the years, only three published significant scientific studies. The first was by a Berkeley team led by Marion Diamond. It reported that one area of Einstein's brain, part of the parietal cortex, had a higher ratio of what are known as glial cells to neurons. This could, the author said, indicate that the neurons used and needed more energy. One problem with this study was that his 76-year-old brain was compared to 11 others from men who had died at an average age of 64. There were no other geniuses in the sample to help determine if the findings fit a pattern. There was also a more fundamental problem. With no ability to trace the development of the brain over a lifetime, it was unclear which physical attributes might be the cause of greater intelligence and which might instead be the effect of years spent using and exercising certain parts of the brain. A second paper, published in 1996, suggested that Einstein's cerebral cortex was thinner than in five other sample brains, and the density of his neurons was greater. Once again, the sample was small, and evidence of any pattern was sketchy. The most cited paper was done in 1999 by Professor Sandra Whittleson and a team at McMaster University in Ontario. Harvey had sent her a fax, unprompted, offering samples for study. He was in his 80s, but he personally drove up to Canada by himself, transporting a hunk that amounted to about one-fifth of Einstein's brain, including the parietal lobe. When compared to brains of 35 other men, Einstein's had a much shorter groove in one area of his inferior parietal lobe, which is thought to be key to mathematical and spatial thinking. His brain was also 15% wider in this region. The paper speculated that these traits may have produced richer and more integrated brain circuits in that region. But any true understanding of Einstein's imagination and intuition will not come from poking around at his patterns of glia and grooves. The relevant question was how his mind worked, not his brain. The explanation that Einstein himself most often gave for his mental accomplishments was his curiosity. As he put it near the end of his life, "I have no special talents. I am only passionately curious." That trait is perhaps the best place to begin when sifting through the elements of his genius. There he is, as a young boy, sick in bed, trying to figure out why the compass needle points north. Most of us can recall seeing such needles swing into place, but few of us pursue with passion the question of how a magnetic field might work, how fast it might propagate, how it could possibly interact with matter. What would it be like to race alongside a light beam? If we are moving through curved space the way a beetle moves across a curved leaf, how would we notice it? What does it mean to say that two events are simultaneous? Curiosity, in Einstein's case, came not just from a desire to question the mysterious. More important, it came from a childlike sense of marvel that propelled him to question the familiar, those concepts that, he once said, the ordinary adult never bothers his head about. He could look at well-known facts and pluck out insights that had escaped the notice of others. Ever since Newton, for example, scientists had known that inertial mass was equivalent to gravitational mass. But Einstein saw that this meant that there was an equivalence between gravity and acceleration that would unlock an explanation of the universe. A tenet of Einstein's faith was that nature was not cluttered with extraneous attributes. Thus, there must be a purpose to curiosity. For Einstein, it existed because it created minds that question, which produced an appreciation for the universe that he equated with religious feelings. Curiosity has its own reason for existing, he once explained. One cannot help but be in awe when one contemplates the mysteries of eternity, of life, of the marvelous structure of reality. From his earliest days, Einstein's curiosity and imagination were expressed mainly through visual thinking, mental pictures and thought experiments, rather than verbally. This included the ability to visualize the physical reality that was painted by the brushstrokes of mathematics. Behind a formula, he immediately saw the physical content, while for us it only remained an abstract formula, said one of his first students. Planck came up with the concept of the quanta, which he viewed as mainly a mathematical contrivance, but it took Einstein to understand their physical reality. Lorentz came up with the mathematical transformations that describe bodies in motion, but it took Einstein to create a new theory of relativity based on them. One day during the 1930s, Einstein invited Saint-Jean Peirce to Princeton to find out how the poet worked. "How does the idea of a poem come?" Einstein asked. The poet spoke of the role played by intuition and imagination. "It's the same for a man of science," Einstein responded with delight. "It is a sudden illumination, almost a rapture." Later, to be sure, intelligence analyzes and experiments confirm or invalidate the intuition, but initially there is a great forward leap of the imagination. There was an aesthetic to Einstein's thinking, a sense of beauty. And one component to beauty, he felt, was simplicity. He had echoed Newton's dictum, "Nature is pleased with simplicity," in the creed he declared at Oxford the year he left Europe for America. Nature is the realization of the simplest conceivable mathematical ideas. Despite Occam's razor and other philosophical maxims along these lines, there is no self-evident reason this has to be true. Just as it is possible that God might actually play dice, so too it is possible that he might delight in Byzantine complexities. But Einstein didn't think so. In building a theory, his approach had something in common with that of an artist, said Nathan Rosen, his assistant in the 1930s. He would aim for simplicity and beauty, and beauty, for him, was, after all, essentially, simplicity. He became like a gardener weeding a flower bed. "I believe what allowed Einstein to achieve so much was primarily a moral quality," said physicist Lee Smolin. "He simply cared far more than most of his colleagues that the laws of physics have to explain everything in nature coherently and consistently." Einstein's instinct for unification was ingrained in his personality and reflected in his politics. Just as he sought a unified theory in science that could govern the cosmos, so he sought one in politics that could govern the planet, one that would overcome the anarchy of unfettered nationalism through a world federalism based on universal principles. Perhaps the most important aspect of his personality was his willingness to be a nonconformist. It was an attitude that he celebrated in a foreword he wrote near the end of his life to a new edition of Galileo. "The theme that I recognize in Galileo's work," he said, "is the passionate fight against any kind of dogma based on authority." Planck and Poincaré and Lorentz all came close to some of the breakthroughs Einstein made in 1905, but they were a little too confined by dogma based on authority. Einstein alone among them was rebellious enough to throw out conventional thinking that had defined science for centuries. This joyous nonconformity made him recoil from the sight of Prussian soldiers marching in lockstep. It was a personal outlook that became a political one as well. He bristled at all forms of tyranny over free minds, from Nazism to Stalinism to McCarthyism. Einstein's fundamental creed was that freedom was the lifeblood of creativity. "The development of science and of the creative activities of the spirit," he said, "requires a freedom that consists in the independence of thought from the restrictions of authoritarian and social prejudice." Nurturing that should be the fundamental role of government, he felt, and the mission of education. There was a simple set of formulas that defined Einstein's outlook. Creativity required being willing not to conform. That required nurturing free minds and free spirits, which in turn required a spirit of tolerance. And the underpinning of tolerance was humility, the belief that no one had the right to impose ideas and beliefs on others. The world has seen a lot of impudent geniuses. What made Einstein special was that his mind and soul were tempered by his humility. He could be serenely self-confident in his lonely course, yet also awed by the beauty of nature's handiwork. A spirit is manifest in the laws of the universe, a spirit vastly superior to that of man, and one in the face of which we with our modest powers must feel humble, he wrote. In this way, the pursuit of science leads to a religious feeling of a special sort. For some people, miracles serve as evidence of God's existence. For Einstein, it was the absence of miracles that reflected divine providence. The fact that the cosmos is comprehensible, that it follows laws, is worthy of awe. This is the defining quality of a God who reveals himself in the harmony of all that exists. Einstein considered this feeling of reverence, this cosmic religion, to be the wellspring of all true art and science. It was what guided him. "When I am judging a theory," he said, "I ask myself whether, if I were God, I would have arranged the world in such a way." It is also what graced him with his beautiful mix of confidence and awe. He was a loner with an intimate bond to humanity, a rebel who was suffused with reverence. And thus it was that an imaginative, impertinent patent clerk became the mind reader of the creator of the cosmos, the locksmith of the mysteries of the atom and the universe.
Einstein, His Life and Universe, was written by Walter Isaacson and read by Edward Herman. The recording engineer was Erica Weintraub. Editing by Stephen Strassman and Erica Weintraub, with post-production by Stephen Strassman. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Travis Tun. Einstein, His Life and Universe, was produced and directed by Carol Shapiro. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.